Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're talking about becoming a volunteer campground host and other ways you can volunteer at our state parks as well. And we have three guests for you with us by phone today, Jim and Bobby Reynolds. They are both experienced campground hosts. Jim and Bobby, thank you so much for joining in today.
It is our pleasure.
And you are welcome.
Okay. Looking forward to talking with you. And with me right here in the studio, Janet Hutchins. She is the Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for our state park system. And Janet, welcome to you.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here today.
So as we talk with our three guests today, I hope you'll join in. Do you volunteer at a park in your area? Maybe you've been a campground host. Tell us about it. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Janet, let's start with you. Why are campground hosts such an important part of our state parks?
Yeah, good question. Really partnering with the public and organizations is a part of our mission in investing in caring for our public lands. And they belong to everyone. So we all want to provide recreation and education opportunities that everybody can enjoy across the state and provide the best customer service. And having those hosts who love our parks is part of that customer service model.
And what are the responsibilities of the hosts?
Yeah, so our hosts, number one, greet and assist our campers with information. So there's all kinds of questions that they have about where to find their campsite, how to set up their campsite. They might want to know what kind of recreation opportunities are available at the property, because each of our properties is different, and what kind of concessions we have available, and maybe our nature center programs, and what time we hold those at the property.
Yeah, and those are a lot of fun.
They sure are.
I've enjoyed those many times. Jim and Bobby, you're both experienced campground hosts. Which parks have you hosted at?
We are hosts during the month of August at Blue Mound State Park. And right now, that's our only hosting responsibility.
And why did you decide to start hosting?
Oh, gosh. Jim, go ahead.
That means you couldn't come up with anything quick. We decided to start hosting because we enjoyed camping, first off. And second, we were wondering, what are we going to do to stay out of mischief once we're both retired? And we wanted to do something that is service-oriented. And hosting clicks all those boxes.
Yeah.
And more.
Yeah, I bet it does. So, in your minds, what are the perks of being a campground host?
Well, we get to meet people from all over the country, and in our case, we've met them from all over the world who have actually been at the park, and that's a big perk.
And they're there to have fun, so they're primarily easy to get along with.
Yeah. And everyone we've met, I think, through an individual, has remarked about how gorgeous, first of all, Blue Mound State Park is, as well as the state parks that they've attended. They seem to think that we have a pretty darn good state park system.
Well, you're not going to find any argument for me on that one. What's a typical day like as a campground host? And, you know, and August is a pretty busy time there. It's a peak season time, I would think.
It is. Go ahead.
A typical day, it depends on the day of the week. If it's Sunday, when almost everybody's moving out, we're scrambling to get the campsites back in order for the next visitor.
Yeah.
We are also scrambling to get our firewood loaded back up. A typical day is a little more relaxed. We may do some of the casual brush trimming and that sort of thing to keep things so we can use it.
We talk to campers when they come in and have questions. A lot of people will say, what's the best trail to get up to the East Tower? Because at the top of the mound in Blue Mound State Park, we are the tallest landmass between Minneapolis and Chicago. So up on the East Tower, if it's a clear day, you can actually see the Capitol building.
Yeah, that is. I've been up there. That's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, beautiful vistas. Yeah.
Great place for stargazing.
Yeah, too.
Yeah, because it's pretty dark up there. You don't have a lot of competing light, do you?
It is. There have been a couple of times when there was going to be a meteor shower. We went up and laid down in the grass and just watched it.
So for somebody listening in saying, maybe I could do that. What are some of the personality skills or personality traits that are helpful to have if you're interested in being a campground host? Jim, start with you.
Okay. You need to be just a little bit gregarious, enjoy meeting people, and usually it's 1, 2, 3 maybe at the most people that you meet at a time. And you need to have a little bit of a helpful
attitude,
orientation. And right off the bat, there's not much conflict, not much heavy work. The requirements that you haven't asked about, but I'll tell you, you're supposed to put in 3 hours of service for each overnight that you camp there. And that covers your camping fee. And quite frankly, we find it very difficult to stop at 3 hours, especially if you total our hours.
So you are I was going to ask about that. So you do as well stay overnight.
Oh, gosh, yes.
You get a site. And it doesn't matter what campground you're on. The camp host, some campgrounds have more than one. The camp host gets a site.
The same site.
Yes, it is a designated site. It's off the, Joe Common can't reserve that site because it's for the camp host. And hopefully there's already one there.
Yeah.
And then along with that, in addition to the talking to folks, we are allowed to use an ATV of some sort. We have a Kawasaki Mule. So we could drive that around. We look and make sure there's no rubbish laying around, anything in the ditches that needs to be picked up. That way we can also, lots of times campers will wave us down and ask questions. So we do that. And we just generally try to make ourselves visible and helpful.
Yeah. And I imagine helping people sort of stay safe while they're out there.
Absolutely. Do you have time for a story?
I do indeed.
Okay. It's been a few years. We don't remember exactly how many, but we got a call from the ranger who was on duty. There was a young lad who had gone missing from his campsite, and he was an autistic guy. He had been bicycling with his brother, and then his brother got separated. His brother looked around, and he wasn't there. So they put out a call, and I guess at that point, probably still is, there's a law that if a adolescent is missing for more than an hour, you have to start calling in the authorities. So we got on our mule and started driving around looking for this guy. And Blue Mound has what's called a hike-in-bike-in site, which is right off of Military Ridge State Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had driven around the campground. We headed down that to see if we were hoping he didn't get on Military Ridge. And we were just turning back up to head back up the bike trail. And here this guy came down just hell-bent for leather on his bike. And we called his name, and he stopped, and we asked if he wanted to go find Mom and Dad. He threw his bike down in a ditch and jumped up in the mule And we grabbed a bike and put it in, and we got it back up to his campsite and his parents. The ranger was standing there with her finger literally on the button to call the sheriff's office because we had 3 minutes to go.
Oh.
And so they were grateful. We were grateful and that it all ended well. And that was a particularly rewarding experience for us.
And Janet, I bet Janet Hutchins, as the coordinator for all this, you've heard many stories, and hopefully most of them are turning out to be positive, like this one.
Oh yes, for sure. And that's we just enjoy hearing our campground host stories and the joy that hosting brings to them. Like they said, meeting people from all over the world and making friends. We have campground hosts who host together at some of our bigger campgrounds that have more than one host site. And they do it together every year, and they've been doing it year after year. And that's their joy in the summertime.
Oh, man. Hans in Door County has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Hans.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Hello.
Hi.
Hello, camp hosts. So I was a fill-in camp host a few years ago at Pottawatomie State Park outside of Sturgeon Bay. Fill-in means I just did a shorter term, only 1 week, because the previous host had to leave early. So I just want to share my experience. I loved it. I had to clean up a lot because the previous host, I don't think, understood that was part of his job. So the first day I was there, I had to clean over 100 campsites. You know, people throw glass bottles into the fire pit and stuff like that, and that needed to be cleaned up. So that was a lot of work. And the other thing that I really enjoyed is helping people find their ways. And I remember, you know, Pottawatomie State Park has a lot of small campsites, not really suitable for large rigs. So one night, a fifth wheeler pulled in. And my gut feeling told me, you know what, I better follow them. And I took the electric vehicle that we had there, and I followed them. And sure enough, I came to their campsite, mm-hmm. and the woman was crying, and the man was cursing, and he tried to back into the campsite, and the brand new fifth wheeler was rubbing against the tree. And I'm like, oh no. So he said, can you park this for me? And I said, well, I tell you, I'm not going to touch your vehicle, but I'll guide you. So those are the kind of emergency moments that will pop up. A couple other things. You know, you're not law enforcement, but every once in a while you have to gently remind people, like, okay, we're not allowing generators. And that happened a few times, and you have to find the most positive tone possible. And then also sometimes people are really speeding through the campground, and it's like, you know, could you just slow down a little bit? You know, there are kids, and it would be, you know, just find a really positive tone. You're not there to enforce anything, but just remind people to be careful, you know. But
yeah, I thanks a lot, Hans, for calling. Janet, a comment?
Yeah, that's a really important role that campground hosts play in just reminding folks of the different rules that we have at the property, typically just to keep everybody safe and have an enjoyable experience. So they do play an important role that way. And that's true that we do provide a camping waiver for so our hosts can perform their duties and stay in our host campsite. So that is a great benefit. And just a reminder that, you know, when the hosts are done working, they can go hike. They can birdwatch. Mm-hmm. They can watch a sunset, take in those beautiful vistas, and really enjoy all that the property has to offer. You know, if they like to kayak or swim, just relaxing and enjoying the park.
Just go and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Hans, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. We are talking today about how you might become, or maybe a relative might become, a volunteer in our parks, in our Wisconsin state parks. Three guests for you: Janet Hutchins, the Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the State Park System, and Jim and Bobby Reynolds, who are campground hosts. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer, Trina LaSousa our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Great to have you along today on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my three guests, Janet Hutchins, who is the Volunteer Services Coordinator for the State Park System, and Jim and Bobby Reynolds, who are campground hosts. And we're talking about becoming a campground host, what's involved, some of the experiences that they have. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Janet, how significant is the need for campground hosts?
Yeah, we do try to recruit new campground hosts every summer. We have a few hundred volunteer campground hosts, but they do retire from hosting.
Sure.
We've had hosts with us for 20, 30 years, coming back year and year, year after year, but they do tend to retire out of campground hosting, and we'd like to see new faces, and even folks who have their summers free. So educators who may have a free summer, or if you have seasonal work and you have your summers free. But we do take volunteers year-round, too, in our other positions. One of the things we're looking for right now is equestrian campground hosts. We have four properties that have equestrian-specific campgrounds where you can bring your horse and camp with your horse,
mm-hmm.
and then ride our trails. And Governor Knowles State Forest, Cattle Moraine Northern Unit and Southern Unit, and Wildcat Mountain State Park all offer equestrian campground host sites and needs.
Jim, were you going to wanted to add in there?
Well, I'm glad she was starting to wander off the direct topic. We have lots of opportunities, probably at every state park, for volunteering, not just as a campground host, but volunteering to do other things like invasive control. Me and my big mouth. Now I can't come up with anything else. But,
we do a lot of habitat work, and folks do citizen monitoring of different species. Maintenance work.
Bike trail maintenance. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trail maintenance.
Back to equestrians for a minute. Well, do you have to have your own horse to be a volunteer on that? Or?
We prefer that, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So the people know, are familiar with what's going on.
That's
with a horse.
Correct.
I haven't been to one of those sites. So the horse is just, you set up your camp and you get your horse and the horse...
We have tie-ups for the horses.
Mm-hmm. Tie-ups for the horses and the horses stay right next to you overnight.
That's right.
Well, that sounds like kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, maybe somebody's listening and says, "Oh, I got horses." That might be kind of fun. What, or just volunteering in general with or without a horse. How do you sign up to become a campground host?
So on the DNR website, you can search for volunteer opportunities or state park volunteer. And you'll find our volunteer webpage that describes the different positions that we have. So, as Jim was saying, we have different positions out there. Besides our campground hosts, we have nature center hosts that serve in the nature center when the hours are open. Naturalists, then we have the property maintenance type of volunteer positions. And adopt a trail, so you can adopt a portion of a trail. So go on the DNR website and search for volunteer opportunities, and you'll see the state park page. And we have all of those positions and where they're located at. You can search by property or type of position on our new online registration system.
And I, as I understand it, I mean, you're looking for opportunities for people with skills, like maybe astronomy, mm-hmm. or it sounds like biology would certainly be a good skill, or photography, perhaps? Writing, maybe?
Correct. Yes, we need volunteers in all different areas. We also have volunteers doing some chainsaw work for that habitat enhancement type of work and eradicating invasives.
And so how much of a time commitment do you need for someone who's interested in volunteering?
Great question. So we have just a couple hour opportunities coming up this April. All throughout the month, we have Work Play Earth Day events where they're drop-in. And you can help clean up the park grounds, get our campground and facilities ready for our busy summer season. Tree planting, we have always have needs for tree planting, removing invasives, like I mentioned before, prairie and habitat restoration, trail maintenance. We have a lot of mountain bike groups that help us with mountain bike trail maintenance. They ride them and then they help take care of them, which is great. And helping our staff with keeping our picnic tables in good working order and checking on our shelters and maybe doing some carpentry work.
So,
if I may jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things at Blue Mound that happens every year is something that attracts people from literally all over the country. And that's a thing that the Friends group puts on, and it's called Horrible Hilly Hundreds. If you're familiar with the area around Blue Mound State Park, there's lots and lots of hills. And so this bike ride is, they have different lengths, but there's a 100-mile bike ride, and it's quite
challenging.
Challenging, yes. And so that's a big event. Janet knows that the Friends of every state park are critical to doing things that the park needs. And so Blue Mound State Park is a very active Friends group that is quite helpful in getting projects done around the park. And last year, we had 40,000 campers at Blue Mound State Park.
Well, that's a lot of people. And I'm trying to think about which one would be more, what's the largest number that we could probably, could be either in Door County or it would be pretty close to Baraboo, I'm thinking.
Yes, those are our two most visited properties.
Devil's Lake.
Peninsula.
And Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And I've spent a lot of time in both. And I'll tell you what, you are right, Bobby, about the hills. I bike through that area. One thing I would say is that the hills in that area, it's a long way up a lot of those hills, but usually then it's a long way down on the other side as compared to Wausau, where it's a long way up and then a very short way down.
Well, the bike trail is on an old railroad grade, so there's not much hill there.
Oh, the whole thing is on a railroad grade. Oh,
the military ridge trail, yes.
Oh, of course.
Yes, but I'm glad you mentioned the Friends groups. We're celebrating our 35th year of our Friends group program, and we have 64 groups across the state that are supporting 69 of our properties. So they're providing thousands of volunteer hours. They do fundraising for park enhancements, and they just generally have a good time. It's a really unique nonprofit service organization focused on a property. And those folks, many of our Friends group board members have been with us for years, and they just love the properties and are always looking for new ways for enhancements. We just started a new outdoor wheelchair program where Friends groups are helping support our all-terrain wheelchair program, and they're helping check it out and show people how to use them. And make them available at our parks.
And those are amazing. Those all-terrain.
Yes.
vehicle. We don't have enough. I'm sure it'd be great to have more than we have.
Yep. The Friends groups are working on that. We have a handful that are available now, and we have groups that are working on fundraising currently. Friends groups are also put on some really fun events. If you want to come out and either volunteer to help put them on or participate, we have 5K and other run, walk, and roll events happening all year. We have seasonal events like our candlelight hikes and snowshoe hikes, which I guess are over for the season now, or maybe they'll pop back up if we get snow this weekend.
Yeah, no.
And then they've also provide a lot of learn-to events, fishing, canoeing, yoga, identifying wildflowers, citizen science. So we really appreciate all of our efforts from our friends groups and the volunteers that they recruit.
Another plug I'd like to put in is that we get to work with some pretty fine staff.
Yeah. Dedicated folks.
Yes.
They absolutely are.
Yeah, I've had had the chance, because I've been, I think, to pretty much every state park in the state, and I usually make it a point to talk to staff. And I have yet to find one that turned me off in any way. They're always friendly and helpful. I will say I forgot to put my state. I thought I had my state sticker on my car, and I didn't. And I got a ticket for it. I took it to the center, and I paid the fine, even though I had it, but I had not put it on, so I paid the fine. But had a fun. And pretty funny time talking with the staff, because a couple of them knew who I was. So
yeah, well, that reminds me that we have a new program out that started last year called Check Out Wisconsin State Parks at Your Library. And you can go to many of the libraries. They're listed on the DNR website, and get a free day pass and visit as many properties as you want on that day. If you haven't been to a state park before, or you're not ready to buy that annual pass, you can get a day pass and check it out. And a lot of libraries have activity backpacks, or they might have binoculars. I know some have snowshoes. So you might want to find out, too, what your library has that you can check out and take with you to a park, forest, or trail.
I like that idea. Jim and Bobby, you've spent a lot of time camping. And here we've got the camping seasons coming up. Maybe there are some tips for being a respectful and responsible camper. And, you know, that first leave no trace is one of the places I camp at. I mean, people would bring rakes and clean up, make sure that was always part of their equipment that they had with them. But leave no trace is a big rule when it comes to the outdoors. And maybe talk about that as it pertains to campsites.
Well, that's a good one. I'm glad you brought it up, because I would say that a very small percentage of our campers make up a very large percentage of our work, because they're very careless about litter. They leave stuff out, and the wildlife carries the packages off into the woods a little ways, just far enough that you can see it, and clean out the package. It's so nice when we come onto a campsite, and the only way we can tell anybody's been there since we were is that there's a few more ashes in the fire pit. We almost do a jig when that happens.
Yeah.
And by and large, the longer we've been there, the more respectful campers have become. Part of that is because when they come into a clean campsite, they tend to leave it clean and respect it for the next person.
When we started, there were not very many posts, and we had our hands full. But like Bobby says, it has let up a lot. We've got quite a few hosts now at Blue Mound.
I'd like to mention one other thing that it's really important that park camp hosts know, and that has to be able to identify poison ivy.
That is a good skill.
It is. I can't tell you how many times we see folks that might be their first time camping, and we see their little ones going out into the weeds to retrieve a ball. And I nearly always stop and say, excuse me, but do you folks know how to identify poison ivy? And if they give me a blank look, I know we're in trouble. No, I know they're in trouble.
Yeah, so you can see what an important role campground hosts have in just the day-to-day kind of camping awareness and education for leave no trace and plant identification. Wild parsnip is another one to be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Right. Jim, go ahead.
No, I just was agreeing. Right?
Oh, okay. Well, the other point that came to my mind, and this this comes as an experience I had, not at one of the state parks, but at another park where on the across the small lake from where our site was, quite a large group of people came in to the park, and the noise was pretty loud, pretty long. And so noise levels and being responsible, maybe comment on that, Jim.
All right. That is where that we don't have law enforcement authority, but we have a little bit of authority because we're the hosts. And the rule of thumb that we follow is if you're so loud that you're bothering other people, you're too loud. And most of them aren't aware that they're interfering with others.
They're laughing and talking to their friends and having a good time.
But if you stop by, at worst case scenario, I strap on the volunteer vest to lend just a little more authority to the white hair and say, you know, you guys are awfully loud. Would you please hold it down? There's others trying to have a quiet time or whatever.
And on the very rare times that there are people who seem to be determined to stay loud, all we have to do is call the local county sheriff, typically.
Or the warden.
If there's a warden there, call the warden.
Nearby, we can call them.
But if it's really bad, we are told, do not try to do this yourself.
Yeah.
Call for law enforcement if at all necessary. So we haven't had to do that very often, maybe three times, four.
Over the years.
Over the years.
And how many years have you been doing this?
I think we're in our 11th year.
So that's... go ahead, Jim, sorry.
I think at least 11 years, But over that time, the number of times we've done it, it's almost never.
Well, I like that. And so, you know, the things that stand out are sometimes they're the kind of the negative things. But on the other side, 99.9% of the time, it's having a good time.
It is. It is. And people are typically very respectful and willing to say, oh, I'm sorry, we didn't know. We'll settle down.
Have a beer.
Janet, how many state parks do we have?
Oh, we have a combination. I always like to say 80 state parks and forests because the state park system manages our forests as well. So we have a lot of our campgrounds are in state forests. So 80 of those. And I wanted to mention 121 state trails.
That's amazing.
So when you think of miles. When you think of an annual pass, you have so many properties that you can visit with that one pass all year round.
Well, I'm going to have to get my pass out of the envelope.
Stick that on your windshield.
And stick it on my windshield. I think the problem was the stamp was the same, which was unusual. The same color 2 years in a row, and I thought I'd stuck it on, but it was last year. The year before. And that's how, and of course I could have just looked and it would have been fine. I give a lot of state park stickers for Christmas gifts. So.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So I always have enjoyed, and people appreciate it for sure. Well, so let's go back just again. If somebody is interested in looking into this, Hey, I could volunteer for, and you could volunteer for what, a week, a month, what, you know.
Yeah,
what?
You can drop in for one of our Work Play Earth Days for just a couple hours and then enjoy the property. Or you can be a returning volunteer and give whatever time that you have. Doesn't have to be on a regular schedule. Or if you have campground hosts, we kind of ask for a month at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some regularity. But some of our campground hosts stay several months. So we really have opportunities for any kind of time commitment that you might have.
And how do we...
I was going to suggest that if you are at a particular park that you've been and you like the location and everything, you might ask to talk to someone right then and there. If there's a park manager who's around, we've had people ask us, how do we do this? And we'll say, well, go to the office and ask for the park manager. I know he's on site today. And talk to Kevin or Brad and see how you'd like to be camp hosts and when, and they can get you started on that process.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. And the other part of it is, just go to the DNR website. Where do we look under once we get to the DNR website, which by the way is a really nice website.
Thank you. You can either go to the parks button at the top of the website. There's different parts of our agency listed up there, or you can type in volunteer opportunities, and then the state parks page will, there'll be a link there.
Pop right up, and, mm-hmm. and there'll be a link. Well, you know what? It's been a lot of fun talking with all three of you. Jim and Bobby, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
You are very welcome.
Glad to do it.
Thank you so much for your service as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks, Janet. You bet.
Yay for the park system.
There we go.
I agree.
And Janet, thank you, of course, so much for coming by. I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to another visit.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it.
Janet Hutchins is the Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the State Park System, and Jim and Bobby Reynolds are campground hosts. Well, we were outside with the camping. We're going to stay outside as we move along here because we're going to talk about cranes. We'll zero in a bit on sandhill cranes, but we can talk other cranes as well with our next guests, Ann Lacey and Ryan Michalasco, our guests next from the International Crane Foundation. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we talk cranes and zero in a bit on sandhill cranes. You know, when I was a kid, it was rare or never. Years would go by where I didn't see would see a sandhill crane. But, you know, we've had, I think you'd call it increased awareness. You might call it effective collaborations going on. Crane populations have recovered dramatically. And today we're talking about all things crane conservation with our two guests from the International Crane Foundation. Ann Lacey, Director of the Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. Ann, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
It is so great to be back. Thank you, Larry.
And with us as well, Ryan Michalasco, the landowner engagement specialist for the foundation. And Ryan, good to see you. Thanks for joining in.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having us.
So, are you a crane lover? Do you live in an area where they visit? probably. They visit a lot of areas in the state anymore. What do you want to know about their population levels or maybe their habitat? Maybe you have an experience to share. You can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Well, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks who are listening today are very familiar with the International Crane Foundation, but I think it's always worth it for those who may not be to talk a little bit about the background of the organization and so forth. Anne, you want to take that?
I sure hope that people know about the International Crane Foundation here in Wisconsin. Why is the International Center for the Study of Cranes in Baraboo, Wisconsin? Anyone? Anyone? Yeah. So it turns out that George Archibald and Ron Sowie are two co-founders. They were in graduate school together at Cornell. And it happened to be they were both working on projects dealing with cranes. And they knew the peril that this family of birds was in. And they thought, we need to have a place where we can work out of that we can try to literally save cranes. And, well, Ron Sowie happened to be from Baraboo, Wisconsin. And his parents' horse farm was idle at the time, and so they rented it out for $1 a year, a bargain at twice the price. And so that was the original site, very close to the city of Baraboo. And then when a old farm became available a little bit out of town, they saw the value of being able to restore the land to a prairie, savanna, and wetlands, natural wetlands there on site, and be able to open up to the public because there was so much interest in all these fascinating birds of the world that, you know, 50 years later, here we are.
Yeah, here we are, man. And funding, I mean, they just didn't dream this up and pay for it all themselves. And,
well, sort of. No,
yeah.
It definitely was started on a dream and a prayer, but a lot of very, very just stalwart supporters right from the very beginning. And they started with a board of directors, knowing that they needed help from the very beginning and that not to do it themselves. So George and Ron could concentrate on their conservation. They had others that were helping them create a very strong business plan as well. But now we work in multitude of countries in Asia and Africa and, of course, here in North America as well.
You know, Jeff in Ellison Bay has a question. Let's just take that right now. Jeff, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm up in Ellison Bay, and there is a huge population of sandhill cranes up here. And I was just curious, where does the actual name, the sandhill portion of the name, what's the origin of that?
Sandhill crane. I've heard many versions of this, but I do believe, so many may be familiar with the big migration through the Platte River Valley in central plains of the United States. That's in Nebraska. And in northern Nebraska, there are these sand hills, literally old dunes that were formed after the glaciers retreated. And they are beautiful, and I highly recommend you go to Nebraska to see those. However, people would see migration of sandhill cranes over those. And so I think that cranes that flew through there were associated with those sand hills.
Thousands and thousands of cranes.
Now, million, yeah.
Million. Mm-hmm. A million cranes.
Yeah.
Wow. It is. Well, I've talked to people who have been there.
It's something. You must see it.
It is. And the sounds.
Mm-hmm. Ryan was just there. If you'd like to describe what
Ryan,
it's like.
Go ahead. Maybe Trina can find us a sandhill crane sound, too, while we're at it.
Yeah, you know, I just returned from a weekend out there in Nebraska on the Platte River, and it's just absolutely incredible, like nothing you've ever seen or heard. It's really, I think, you know, prehistoric is a really good way to describe it, just like nothing you've seen before, a force of nature.
Yeah, and it's it is so fun this time of year to hear, you know, to be out about outside, maybe on a bike, maybe on a walk, and hear that sandhill sound.
That sign of spring that comes earlier and earlier lately. Yes.
What are they up to this time of year, the cranes?
Well, it's mostly the breeding birds that are back. So they are on their territory saying, this is mine, everybody else come out. So it's real estate. They need to come back and get their house in order before somebody else comes back and claims it. So most of the birds that are, we're hearing unison calls, of course, that is their claim to that place. And it's on and on and on. It'll wake you up earlier and earlier as the sunrise gets earlier.
Karen in Delafield, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I had told this story a few years ago with the director of the Crane Foundation, but we live above Nagawicca Lake on a hill, and by the pond that feeds into the lake, we have a nest of cranes every year. One year, about 3 years ago, I heard a crane walking up our driveway, and I was having coffee outside, and it walked right past me, like 8 feet away, and walked over to our deck and flew down and took a swim in our pool. And then...
Bold.
It was just... it had no fear of me. I didn't move. I didn't have my dogs up, so that was good. But it was just really funny. He swam from the deep end to the shallow end, walked up the steps of the pool, and then back down another part of the hill. And they're familiar with us. I think it was one of those things where they fly over so often, it was tempting.
Maybe so. It's interesting because cranes can swim, of course, but they would rather walk, and so they prefer shallow wetlands. So maybe he didn't realize it was the deep end of the pool when he jumped in.
Well, he did fine, and I think maybe the color really drew it, you know? I don't know.
And you without your camera.
And you, without your camera. Karen, thank you so much for calling. Somebody says, well, what are they actually, how do you tell it's a sandhill if you're out there?
Oh, so sandhills naturally are gray colored. With a red head, that striking red cap on top that cranes are known for, and a white cheek patch. But the breeding sandhills in Wisconsin, also, they paint their feathers, meaning they take the iron-rich soil that we have here in Wisconsin, and they'll literally rub it into their feathers. And that iron-rich soil oxidizes, and that rusty color paints their feathers red. So we often see very, very red sandhills. If you see something that looks like a crane, and it's big and it's white, it's a whooping crane, which we also have here in Wisconsin. So we are blessed with the most abundant of the 15 crane species and the rarest of the crane species here in Wisconsin and North America.
Yeah, that's pretty cruel. And how many species are there?
15 total. 15 total.
Amy in Plover will give you a chance. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to share an experience that I had. So my husband and I, when we had one baby at the time, probably 2 years old, and we went to Nebraska to see the sandhill cranes. Now, we were kind of with a tour-ish kind of thing where we just got on a bus and rode out there. But I have to tell you, it was one of the most amazing and magical, in a weird way, experiences I've ever had because they took us out in the dark. And they said, you have to be very quiet. You can stand here, here, and here, you know. And as the sun came up, we just started hearing this call of the cranes. And all of a sudden, there were thousands and thousands and thousands all around us. Yes.
like that times 10,000.
Thanks, Trina. That was great. You know, thanks, Amy, for calling, by the way. Well, that's what it sounds like, Ryan.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And Amy, you're exactly right. It really is an experience to go out there. We have a lot of conservation partners at the Roe Sanctuaries managed by Audubon Society and the Crane Trust, and they do a marvelous job at leading those early morning and evening tours. You sneak out there and get your view of the cranes.
And hear the sounds. So you get your camera out and you've got your sound going and video something like that.
Yeah, and the pictures are always gorgeous, but it just really doesn't capture what it is like being there in person. There's nothing like seeing it in person.
Well, we can see plenty of them around here, not to that extent, but we can see a lot of them. The Sandhill populations, I mean, compare, what are the population? What is the population now?
The latest count, so every autumn, the Fish and Wildlife Service hosts a count, so that we are volunteers during for that count. The International Crane Foundation counts about 5 spots. Many other people in the entire upper Midwest and even eastern states now count sandhill cranes in the eastern population. So that's what all of our cranes, and they migrate to the southeast. Not part of the Platte River population, the birds that migrate through there. The last count, last October, was over 100,000 birds. And so it's an estimate, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, we can get a pretty good idea of where all these birds are at that time of the year then. So it is definitely growing. We don't know at what rate it's going exactly and where it is growing also. It's expanding probably to the east and to the north and the south.
Well, we are going to have a chance to talk some. There's some other things I want to talk about. You know, there's always, there have been many times hunting seasons have been proposed for sandhill cranes. I want to get what Ann and Ryan think about that. And, of course, your questions about cranes and their habitat are certainly welcome. We are going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the on Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll be back with our guest, Ann Lacy, director of the International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program, and Ryan Michalesko. Michalesko, I don't know why I have trouble with that. He is the landowner engagement specialist for the International Crane Foundation, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Larry Mueller here. We're giving you an update about sandhill cranes on the program today with our two guests, Ryan Michalesko. One of our guests is the landowner engagement specialist for the foundation. I want to dig in a little bit more about what's all going on there. And Ann Lacy with us, back with us as well. She's the director of the foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. So, are you wondering how you can get involved with crane conservation, or are you curious about the group of sandhills you see during your commute? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, Ann, I'm just going to go to you for a minute here before I go to Ryan. The visitor center, that updated visitor center, which, I mean, I like the old one. But the new one is really, really nice.
Phenomenal? Yeah, that's a word you could use. I don't know when we can stop calling it new because
it's been a couple, 3 years now. Yeah. But
it is still, we still get rave reviews, rave reviews about that. Our visitor program is ready to go when we open up to the public May 1st. And so we have the only place in the world where you can see all 15 species of crane in one place. And we have beautiful exhibits that showcase each pair of birds in what we would an interpretation of where you would see them, where they actually occur in the world, because we only have two species here in North America. And so that between that and our interpretive programs that really talk about what threats they face in where they live and strides that we are making to ensure their safety and the people that inhabit those same landscapes, it's really great, and we can't wait to open up to everybody May 1st.
And you know what I'd do? I would do what I did the last time, and I'd do it again, and that is to hook up with one of the guides or one of the folks. I really think, I mean, I walked around on my own, but I really think it adds so much to the experience to take a little tour with.
We do have self-guided tours, and we have several miles of nature trails also through our restored prairie and our wetlands and woodlands. But hearing about our work worldwide and the things that people are doing to save cranes worldwide, it's definitely worth being on one of the organized tours as well that we do regularly.
And we should probably also mention crane counts.
Crane count. Some of you out there, I know, are long-time county coordinators, and so know what the annual sandhill count became, the annual Midwest sandhill count became, the annual crane count because we have two species now and we're well outside of the Midwest even. So April 13th, two blissful hours outside listening and counting cranes. So there's more information on our website about that, savingcranes.org. But please look for information there on how to contact your county coordinator and maybe find a site to go out and count cranes on April 15th. Or, yeah. Excuse me, April 13th.
13th.
Lucky 13, yeah.
Yeah, on the 15th, we're all busy sending our taxes in.
Weeping quietly in a corner, yes.
Well, I want to turn to you, Ryan, for a bit, and maybe Ant can join in too. But the U.S. Department of Ag estimates that sandhill cranes cause about $1 million in crop damage here in Wisconsin. So you're the landowner engagement specialist for the International Crane Foundation. Maybe explain what that job entails, and then let's talk about the crop damage too.
Yeah, Larry. So my position focuses on all things crop damage. So the International Crane Foundation has been working, you know, for several decades in a lot of these agricultural areas to figure out how we can best resolve crop damage by sandhill cranes. And, you know, it's often pointed to that a hunting season is the primary solution by a lot of the proponents for hunting season. And, you know, we don't believe that, but we've been trying to find real solutions that can help farmers here and now and try to get some money in their pockets to help them prevent crop damage before it even happens.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a non-toxic chemical. I think it's called Avapel.
Yeah, that's right. It's a chemical seed treatment. It's basically a taste deterrent. So the cranes that come into the fields, you know, they're looking for forage as their breeding season starts to pick up here in Wisconsin. And they use the freshly sprouted corn as little flags, and they'll go right down the rows of corn and eat that seed. And Avapel gets coated on the seed before it's planted, and it just serves as a taste deterrent that prevents them from eating it.
But we've seen, well, at least my understanding is that it's been difficult to get all farmers using it.
Yeah, that's right. So right now it's really an issue of cost. So that's what we're trying to do here, working, you know, several different avenues, but hopefully with the state we can try to get some funding into farmers' hands to make this product more affordable and more widespreadly used.
Well, and it's kind of surprising, perhaps, in a way. I mean, there's farmers are reimbursed for crop damage from what? Deer, elk, bear, geese, turkeys. So why not cranes?
That's right. It's that particular program that you're citing is called the Wildlife Damage Abatement Compensation Program, and you're exactly right. It goes down the list: deer, bear, turkey, geese, sandhill cranes, if there is a hunting season. So, you know, that's currently the impediment that's preventing funds going out to farmers, and we're trying to find a way that we could get that released without, you know, putting the population at risk by opening up a hunting season.
Yeah, and there's not a whole lot of support
for a hunting season?
Yeah,
As a matter of fact, we have some information on that very subject.
Yeah, so this is something that ICF has long believed, that a hunting season's not popular to the citizens of Wisconsin, but it's never been objectively looked into. So the International Crane Foundation partnered up with the UW-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, as well as the UW Survey Center. And late last year, we conducted an objective scientific study to ask that very question of do the people of the state support a hunting season? And we found, you know, really, the question is no. Fewer than 7% of the state citizens strongly support a hunting season, and fewer than 18% actually do support it. While on the other end of that, almost half of the state, 47.6%, oppose a hunting season, and 29.6%, so almost a third of the state citizens strongly oppose a hunting season. So, you know, this is a big issue, but we ask the question of if a hunting season's not going to solve the issue of crop damage by means of population control, if it's not going to solve it financially by getting money to the farmers, and the people of Wisconsin don't want it, then why are we even talking about it?
Yeah, yeah. Jen in Stevens Point has a different question. Let's go there. Hi, Jen.
Hello, thanks so much for taking a call. My husband and I were fortunate enough to be down in the Florida Keys recently, and when we were there, we saw a whooping crane flying overhead. And so we were curious about the population of whooping cranes and if how their expansion is going and whether or not they still are aided in their migration to the south. If the population is still in the Mosquito Wildlife Refuge, and if that's the case, how that's going as well.
Okay.
Yeah. All things whooping cranes. So there are still members of a non-migratory reintroduction that is in Florida. They are usually in central Florida. They were released in the Kissimmee Plain. There's only 5 of those birds left, as a matter of fact. So what you saw, if it was a big white bird with black wingtips, it might have been a wood stork, which has also moved from endangered to no longer endangered very recently. Has had an amazing comeback. So we hope the same for the whooping cranes. But the ones here in Wisconsin that were famously taught the migration route by ultralight aircraft for a decade and a half, starting here in Wisconsin, originally at Nacida National Wildlife Refuge, as you mentioned, to the Florida Gulf Coast, that is no longer happening. We have a strong enough adult population that we can rear birds either in costume or parent-reared. So those are chicks raised by real whooping cranes, but in captivity. Mm-hmm. And they are released into the fall in the company of older birds. And so that is how they learn their migration route. And it could be anywhere from northern Indiana to Tennessee to Alabama. We only have one that goes further south than that we know of right now. So they kind of spread themselves out in the wintering areas, much like the sandhills. There are still our core of the breeding area of whooping cranes in Wisconsin is in Nacida. So you are probably going to see one if you go to visit that beautiful refuge. They're also breeding at Horica National Wildlife Refuge and also in White River Marsh. It's a state wildlife area in east central Wisconsin. And then in private lands scattered about here and there. So they're still in Wisconsin, and we're still working on making that a sustainable population.
Jan, thanks so much. I appreciate your call. Edie in Baraboo will go to you. Hi, Edie.
Hi, Larry. And guests, a few years ago, I went out to Kearney and that area to see the migration, and it was absolutely awesome. But the thing I loved the most was the snow geese. The fields were just white with them. And then I learned about the prairie chickens up in Burwell, Nebraska. So I went up there and saw that, and that was another spectacular thing.
I have been to Burwell. I've seen those same chickens. They're absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it was really fun. On the way home, I got stuck in the middle of Iowa for 2.5 days in a snowstorm. But it was wonderful. So I think everyone should go and see it.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that plug. And I can't agree more. And about the snow geese, it is quite spectacular. But that kind of that puts a fine point on how many millions of waterfowl and other migratory birds that use a very, very narrow alley in the central flyway, and how everybody needs to eat and they're refueling for their long migration up to the Arctic in some cases, and sandhills even further through Alaska into mm-hmm. Siberia for nesting. And so, yeah, there's a lot of them right now, but it's knowing that there's enough food and resources for all of those birds is of critical importance.
Yeah. Edie, thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Number 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Somebody else is wondering why this crane count, why is it so important?
It is a way to, it's not a count as the fall survey is to get a population estimate. For us, it is more a way to build awareness, not just of cranes, but of the wetlands that are in our neighborhood. You don't need to have a pristine wildlife area to have cranes. I'm sure a lot of people are aware of that. But it lets us know where these birds are expanding to. You know, nobody likes to count zero cranes on a crane count. But to us, that's important when a zero turns to one or two or more. So it is really important to highlight the importance of wetlands in Wisconsin and throughout the upper Midwest, for all species, but also just to have get people keep people outside and build awareness for cranes too.
And you try to get the volunteers to spread out. I mean, how does that work anyway?
Yeah, the county coordinators are champions here. They know how to assign people and kind of can wrangle people to where there's already enough coverage or where we need more. Some places have been counted in the past, and the counters are no longer going there. So we need to cover those areas again, and the county coordinators really know where to put people. And so I really encourage people to look on our website, savingcranes.org, and search crane count. Actually, we have a direct line. If you type in www.cranecount.org, it'll give you all the information you need to get involved.
Let's go to Lori and Nina next. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you guys for all the great work you do for our cranes. My question is Wisconsin a nesting location rather than a fly-through for crane breeding? And when the proposals for hunting seasons come up, wouldn't that be occurring in the fall? So it wouldn't really be doing anything for elimination of crop destruction. And those were my questions. So thank you.
Yeah. Ryan, you want to take that?
Yeah, you made two really great points, and the first of which is, yes, Wisconsin is a breeding grounds for the sandhill and whooping cranes. We have a lot of cranes coming into the area this time of the year, and that's one of the reasons that crop damage is so prevalent here in Wisconsin. It's just the migration and the growing season align so perfectly. But that also underscores the second issue that since Wisconsin is a breeding ground, if we were to have a hunting season here, we're not quite sure how it'll affect a population. If you remove too many of the breeding pairs, it could have a detrimental effect on the population. And since cranes are takes a long time for them to mate and actually breed and bring up young, we're not quite sure how that could impact the population.
It would. It's not likely that we're going to get a bill on this, is there? I mean,
you know, it's. It seems like that conversation comes up in cycles. It was last brought up in the 2022 legislature, and they failed to actually do anything on it. But you know, we're really calling on the public and the legislature to take the issue seriously for farmers and look at real solutions that are going to make a difference.
So, aside from Avapel, what other kinds of things are you researching or looking at?
Yeah, so Avapel is the primary deterrent, but we're looking into other solutions that farmers could use. For example, effigy. So, for example, the USDA currently issues depredation permits that allows landowners to harvest what they call nuisance birds. And, you know, in order to prevent a de facto hunting season, those birds can't be used for anything. So what happens if we leave those birds out in the fields? I guess you could call it bad juju if it, you know, keeps other birds away. But at the same credit, if you could use decoys, for example, to scare off those birds. There's a lot of really new technology, AI lasers. I call them space scarecrows that you can put out in the fields. We're not quite sure how those will work. But, you know, we're really trying to look at the broad spectrum here and find solutions for farmers.
Yeah, other than the hunting season, for sure. Jake and Trempolo, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great conversation. I love the sandhill cranes for sure. So I was born and raised in Lincoln, Nebraska, and lived there for the first 20-plus years of my life. And I can vividly remember going on field trips with the school every spring to Kearney, Nebraska, to see the migrations and to be present and take part in that. And just the absolute wonder of the massive migration of sandhill cranes that would land on the Platte River. It's just a beautiful thing, and I would highly, highly recommend it to anybody who's into birding or even just wanting to see something wonderful to check that out. It's just an amazing jaw-dropping experience. And then for the next 20-so years, I didn't see a single one, not a single crane, until I moved back or to move to Wisconsin. And I moved to Trempolo real close to Perot State Park, and now I see them quite frequently again, which is awesome because they are a spectacular bird to follow. But I had a question in regards to their mating habits. I guess I've never looked into it, but for the last several years, I see what appears to be a couple, male, female, that are always in the cornfield across the street from my house. And I was just curious as to whether or not they might be the same birds, or if they mate different every year, if they keep lifelong mates like some Canadian geese, things like that. So I'll take the answer off the air, and thanks again for taking my call.
All right. Thanks for calling.
They are indeed monogamous, with the rare exception they do divorce. Mm-hmm. So they we have documented divorce in cranes, and that's our word for it. But they have switched mates without the death of a mate. So that then we have yet to figure out if it's you or it's me, or you know how they choose to do that. But we have a long term banding program that we have in a small study area here in central Wisconsin, and our long term data shows that it is often the very same birds that come back to the same territory for decades. Sometimes they are very long-lived birds. They can live to 30 or 40 years in the wild. And so more often than not, it probably is the same bird. But unless they are marked, it really isn't quite a ways to know for sure.
What's the biggest obstacle facing crane conservation, do you think?
Generally, yeah, worldwide, it's... They're the habitats that they require, so they are obligate nest wetland nesters, by and large. But they also need water to roost in. They can't roost in trees, with the exception of the crowned cranes in Africa. And so, wetland resources, food resources, you know, agricultural areas for our sandhills. That's quote unquote critical habitat. They really need those and enjoy those cornfields on migration, especially in places like Nebraska. But with encroachment, with things like solar farms going in, you know, green power is a good thing. We need more renewable energy. However, that takes a lot of what is often row crop agriculture out of circulation for the birds to forage in. So these are things that we're trying to keep track of. Power lines, you know, coming in more closely into contact with people, be it in suburban areas or with farming. These are all, you know, problems that we're trying to solve.
So solar actually has an impact.
It does. It does. And they, you know, they think, well, it's just an old, big old empty field. And, you know, green power is good. Green power is good. But, you know, there's siting issues that we are really trying to keep track of.
Yeah, and there are, you know, this whole business about food and land. I mean, you talked about the very narrow strip.
In Nebraska.
Yeah.
Larry, I think we're going to have to do a show from Kearney, Nebraska next year. Everybody go to Nebraska and see millions of sandhills.
I would love to do that. I would love to be in Kearney, Nebraska when they're, although it'd be hard to hear ourselves talk on the air this was happening. Well, and here we are out of time. Again, what's your website again?
All things crane information, savingcranes.org. Or if you want to know more about our crane count, you can go directly to cranecount.org.
And Ryan, thank you both so much. Appreciate it. We'll get you back and we'll do it again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Ann Lacy, director of the International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyway Program in North America. And Ryan Michalesko is the landowner engagement specialist for the International Crane Foundation. Great to have them with us. And I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's what sometimes happens. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about how suburban malls and old office buildings are being given a second life and adding value and creativity to their communities. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio.